I think that biting off challenges and biting off new areas of expertise is something best done with mentorship, experienced people who have fought the battles before you, and learn from them and humble yourself before them.
Welcome to the Rent to Retirement Podcast, your resource for passive real estate investing and retirement strategies. If you're new to real estate or planning your financial future, you're in the right place. Join us at renttoretirement.com to find your path to financial freedom and an easy, carefree retirement. Enjoy the show.
Hey, Rent to Retirees, it's Adam Schrader here with another episode, and I am joined today by Spencer Hilligoss. He is the CEO of Madison Investing, and we're going to talk today about his journey. Spencer, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, Adam, thank you for hosting me. I appreciate it. I'm excited to be here.
Absolutely. So we always like to start off and just hear how your investing journey got started, because, you know, so many people are looking into real estate, thinking about it, but haven't gotten started. So what kicked you into that investor role?
My goodness. I'll try to keep it brief, but you know, I was in tech companies in Silicon Valley for 13 years. That was not my original path. I was a guy who, my dad was a broker in real estate for 30 years. So technically, I guess I started in real estate from the very beginning. That's what scared me into tech. So, you know, I remember working open houses for my dad as a teenager, you know, cleaning out rental property, et cetera. Not very cool feeling to tell your friends who are, you know, working at tech companies, hey, I'm going to go and do all this really glamorous stuff in real estate. In hindsight, though, man, he was doing outstandingly growing a brokerage business in the 90s. And now looking full circle, I've come on the other side of a 13-year tech career. I was in financial tech companies all that time, building teams, you know, up to a couple hundred people. Around, you know, by the time I was age 27, I was like, wow, I'm in over my skis on this leadership thing. But that's how you learn, right? And ultimately, a mentor of mine around 2016, he nudged me into the fifth tech company I was working at. And I was brought in to grow and scale the loan origination groups, not knowing what that meant at the time, at the biggest fix and flip company in the country. It was called Lending Home. You know, they've rebranded to Chiavi, I think now. A lot of friends still there. And I went down the rabbit hole. I saw the net worths and the transactions and all the stuff on the other side, inside the guts of a lender doing 600 loans per month, Adam. And I was like, Jennifer is my better half. She's my co-founder in our company, as well as my wife of 11 years. And we had our own careers, separate careers that were very successful, dual income household, two young boys now, you know, growing family, et cetera, in the Bay Area, California. But there, we didn't see an off-ramp from that those long work hours. And so I went down the rabbit hole, read 24 books in an 18-month period during the early years of trying to figure out how I wanted to get more involved in real estate. And then bought some rentals and eventually started investing in bigger deals from there. But the rest is history. Now we have a passive investing club with hundreds of active investors. And I retired from my corporate career in 2019.
Nice. So tell us about the first deal you did. I'm sure you remember that one. So tell us about the first one.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because I guess this is a pretty common path. In hindsight, I can break it into three very simple phases. And this is phase one, that first deal. We couldn't get comfortable buying sight unseen. You know, a lot of people just like, they kind of cringe at the idea. I did too. So did Jennifer, buying a rental property that was thousands of miles away from us. But we drove around the Bay Area market with our infant son in the car, whole summer, finally found a cash flowing rental in the Bay Area. $430,000 purchase price, Adam, for a duplex. And that thing cash flows $200 a month, which in California, you know, that is actually pretty darn good that it cash flows at all. It is stable and we still own that rental. It's the only small property rental that we still own. We'll come back and buy more eventually. But that taught us a lot of lessons about what it means to invest for cash flow. And that was a learning there, my friend. our dollars couldn't go very far when you're putting $6,000, you know, we used a loan on that, of course. The fixed rate on that's looking pretty darn good as of 2023. You know, in hindsight, that $100,000 we put down cash, I think we could have stretched it a bit further had we learned, you know, you can get a $60,000 property in the Midwest that cash flows for $250 a month, which is what we did after that. So
So why do you still own that one? I mean, you know, we were talking just before we got started and you were saying that, you know, California isn't a place that y'all are investing now. So what is it, just sentimental value at this point in time, or why, what's led y'all to keep that one?
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you asking that. I think just quick context would be, you know, we've learned throughout this journey with Jennifer and I, not the royal we, you know, she's my co-pilot in this life and business, that cash flow goal setting, you know, like the, what's the goal for the money question was the question I wish I could go back in time and ask myself, you know, now having been on the sides of so many dozens of deals from small to big apartments, self-storage facilities, et cetera. What's the goal for the money? And at that goal, we didn't understand in that first purchase. But then we learned afterwards, okay, if we wanted to hit a certain dollar amount of passive income per month, which we did then, and we've hit our number since then, faster than we expected to, which we're very proud to say, hard fought. But that thing appreciated a few hundred grand. That one property has already appreciated a few hundred grand. Was that the purpose of that investment? No. Would we have reallocated that capital, that, you know, six-figure number, into a different set of investments? In hindsight, because it would have been a smarter move to deploy towards something that could hit our monthly cash flow number faster. Absolutely. But now, my goodness, fixed rate debt, fixed rate loans, you know, certainly in the fours on a duplex, are looking pretty darn attractive right about now. There's just no reason to move on it right now, which is really the purpose. We did, if I had to say, bridge it over to, I mentioned that as like phase one in our investing journey, passive investing journey. Phase two was we actually went out and did buy. We got up to 5 single family rental properties in the Midwest. We were investing in Kansas City. On average, you know, $250 a month in cash flow. That's great, right? and roughly $60,000 a pop for each of those. It blew our minds, right? I mean, blows the minds of any person buying from coastal markets coming from that as the norm. And in hindsight, we also learned the lessons of, well, what happens when you invest in C-class properties in places that no matter how much diligence you've done, you got a property manager on that thing. You got to make sure you buy with the right partners. You got to make sure you do your diligence. You got to make sure it's the right phase, the right stage of your life for wanting to still have some kind of management hands-on, because there's great rentals out there. We did get a couple in that mix that I would say you learn the lesson of what happens when you get the tenant who decides to turn your property into more of a demolition derby, and how much your turnover costs spike when you have to fill that unit, you know. And so we have since gone and sold those properties actually to at a better profit. But, you know, we decided to come back and we kind of look up market a bit more after that. But that's why we held on to it, frankly. We didn't have a reason to move on the first one imminently.
Nice. So you're talking about the teams and the markets that you moved into. And what led you into, I mean, obviously you moved away from California, but what led you to the Midwest? Kind of what were you seeing? What do you look for in markets now whenever y'all are going in to invest? What are some of the key things that are driving your decisions for where to go?
Oh, that's a fun topic. you know, a person far smarter than I years ago, you know, came up with this notion of the three pillars of that vetting a passive real estate deal. Applies to rentals, applies to apartments, applies to storage, applies to anything where someone else could be at the steering wheel and you're trusting them with your capital and your asset. And pillar one is the who, you know, who you're doing that with, who you're investing with, who's the manager on that deal. If it's an apartment building, it's going to be the asset management team, property management team. If it's a rental, still going to be a property manager, but focused on residential. The second of those pillars is where to the market. And you're talking the big footprint and then down to the neighborhood, right? Markets and a submarket. And the third being everything else. Like if there's a plan being used on that asset, like if it's a, whether it's a BRRRR, you're going to buy a rental property and fix it up somehow to sell it. These days, we focus a lot more on big value add properties, as well as some self-storage stuff for multifamily and apartments, but in storage. But all that said, I didn't come up with that framework. The high level version was established by someone far, far smarter than I. But it gives you a foothold. It gave me a foothold to start looking at these deals, because I'm a framework guy, Adam. Like I came from very like operation heavy leadership roles, and I've always appreciated like having predictability, you know, like, how, like, can you put it in a spreadsheet? It just takes away the mystery. Be able to kind of look at something, predict it, forecast, because none of us have crystal balls, and I certainly don't either, certainly in 2023. But I really think what matters most for market selection, which is back to your question, is I love places that have friendly ownership laws, business-friendly regulations, business-friendly climates, economy, job growth. Jobs is like the number one metric, I think, if you had to boil it down, oversimplified. What are you looking for there? You know, you're looking for jobs. You're looking for predictability and expectation of more jobs and job stability. Big employers sticking around. You know, people pay attention when an Amazon facility goes in. I pay attention when any governmental sort of facility goes into a place or is expected to expand in a certain market. So we've focused heavily on, more so, I'd say, Sun Belt. We've done a lot of stuff in the Sun Belt, all the way from Texas out to Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, a little bit of Florida, and gotten moved a bit further in the recent years back closer to like looking at my former home in Colorado and, you know, even in Phoenix, Arizona. You know, so it runs the gamut, but I would say big focus on the Sun Belt and still very much looking at some Midwest stuff as it comes down the pipeline for us as well.
What's the difference in vetting deals between, you know, you've kind of done many different asset classes, between vetting a deal as a single family versus, you know, multifamily versus a storage unit? Is the due diligence kind of all the same? Does it vary? You know, how does it vary asset to asset? Can you run us through a little bit of that? Because we have a lot of people who are currently single family, but looking at getting into, you know, bigger deals, maybe commercial, maybe apartments, maybe self-storage, maybe mobile home parks. Can you tell us a little bit about the difference in vetting those deals?
Yeah, happy to. You know, and as funny as it might sound, I try to stick to my swim lanes as I become competent in a relative asset class. It's just one of those core principles, Adam. Like, I don't know about you, but every step of my life and career, when I just stick to what I know, things go better. Right. You know, one of the earlier mentors in my career was like, always stretch your comfort zone, you know, like devour knowledge, seek counsel, like go out and learn from others, you know, skin your knees, but don't necessarily stretch so far that you can't necessarily learn from it and still recover. I give that caveat because right now, we've partnered on 45 commercial real estate deals today since our single family journey. And more than half of those have been large apartment deals, you know, 150 plus units, self-storage facilities as well, mixed in there as well. So about, you know, 20-30% of those deals are self-storage. And I just love those asset classes because, frankly, man, they are boring in the best way. I love it. It's the best kind of boring. Boring is the new sexy in 2023, in case anyone didn't notice. And single family plays a huge role in I think, for the overall asset class landscape of really favorable investments if people choose wisely. But the bottom line here to your question, Adam, is that if something works, don't change it. You know, and vetting, if you are going to hand off management on a single family home, if I'm going to go buy a single family property, pay my 10%. And I know a lot of people say they can get lower than 10%, but most people pay 10% at least for the property manager on their long distance rental or a long distance rental out there. Take the time to vet that person, or more appropriately, that team. And hopefully it's a team, because they should have infrastructure. And so there is, yeah. You know, if it's one dude or one gal sitting in their house and, you know, run. But all joking aside, before we made our first passive investment in a big apartment building, Jennifer and I, you know, we had to wire a 5-digit number. And at this point, I'm very proud to say we've invested over 7 figures of our own money in passive deals over the last 6 years. And that's hard fought. You know, some people can drop much bigger numbers than that than me, but that's a heck of a lot to us over a period of time we've worked hard for. 5-part vetting framework that we built for our own investing purposes, which now also is it's a foundation for how we vet the who. Because the who is where all the risk comes from. If I'm not the person managing the deal, it comes down to who's the steering wheel, right? And so I think number one is team. Like, who's on that team? What is their relationship together? You know, how long has that team been around? Track record. Have they done this for a while? Have they done it before? Have they done it full cycle? Have they bought a property and then sold it later? Same thing for an apartment building. Same thing for a storage facility at this altitude. Communication. I mean, like, This sounds so fundamental, man. Bad news delivered quickly is always going to be better received by a more experienced investor. And I learned that from, people with more gray hair than I have. I mean, I have a couple of young kids, so I'm getting more every day, man. But it's okay to hiccups happen. It's real estate. You know, great wealth is built in these asset classes, but no one should come in with the expectation of perfection. So I think that communication timely and transparently is key. Just to tie it on a bow, I think values and approach sounds corny. it matters to me at least that, like, you know, going in to buy these hard assets, whether it's a single family or a 200-300 unit apartment building, they are a financial vehicle. I'm very much a capitalist like the rest of us, human beings living these buildings, you know? I think people will ask me sometimes after, you know, chatting about vetting passive deals and passive teams that manage the deals. They're like, isn't that kind of squishy? And I'm like, I don't consider it squishy if I ask a sponsor or an operator, you know, raising capital on an investment, what's your stated philosophy on tenant relations and tenant experience? I'm not looking for them to give me a perfect answer, but I sure hope that they have one. Or they've thought about it. But I don't want to give you too much more of a soapbox. I'll just say repeatable approach, if I had to boil it down. If they've done something enough, they should hopefully have like a repeatable approach that they've established. And same thing applies to business as an entrepreneur or in the corporate world, or if you're doing a fix and flip, or if you're doing a value add playbook, heavy or light on an apartment building, you should have a stated playbook because you've done it before. Anyways, thanks for listening to my diatribe.
Yeah. So one of the things that a lot of people, as they get into a lot of different aspects of their life, whether it's, you know, running their own business or investing, is the whole kind of fraud syndrome where they feel like they don't know enough that they can talk to other people about it. You felt comfortable enough and obviously have been successful now at doing it to build your company the way you have and to help and helping other people invest their money. When did you get to the point where you felt confident enough as an investor to actively go out and say, hey, you should trust me with your money now? Mm.
Oh my goodness. That is a killer question. I think that biting off challenges and biting off new areas of expertise is something best done with mentorship, experienced people who have fought the battles before you and learn from them and humble yourself before them. That was my goal, was to go in and say, this was never intended to be a business. Just candidly, it wasn't. This started out as us working full-time jobs, making good money in that life, and realizing, oh, that went well on those investments. And then talking to colleagues and having colleagues say, what did you just do on that investment? And ultimately, that happened enough times. Having a network I'd worked hard to build over years to have them come back and say, hey, you know, Spencer, like, are you doing these types of deals? We probably want to work with you if you could. And then just going out and networking like a madman, Adam. I think ultimately going through coaching programs, you know, I do think that it is a vast ocean of coaching programs, as you know, and many folks that do one Google search will find. There's a ton of education out there, and it is very worthy to search for like coaching programs led by great people that can help you get to where you got to get to. So I've used at least four. I don't think people should go in blindly to do it, but that was incredibly helpful for me because there's definitely some ones you got to make sure you double, triple check on a few coaching programs out there, make sure that they're, you know, reputable, all that stuff. But that was key for me, was having someone, going to someone and saying, let me add value to you as you go buy this next property. How can I do that? Or even better, let me reframe that even. To say it as, here's how I can go add value to you. I think that that's really the main shift. And for me was like, I've invested in these deals. I read 24 books in 18 months, which is way more than anyone needs to go do. That is called procrastination after book number three, for sure. Did listen to like 400 plus podcasts, like great ones like this one, you know, where you're delivering meaningful, actionable education for people. And that's part of the journey, though. I still think people should take their time, you know, to digest. Don't just consume for consumption, consume to learn. But then, you got to get out there and you got to repeat these concepts you're soaking up back to a person and be comfortable when they call you out for saying something stupid sometimes, because if they aren't, because if you're not hitting that wall, man, then you're probably not pushing it hard enough, right?
Absolutely. You mentioned that nowadays y'all are looking for like big time value adds when it comes to your projects. So how do you tell the difference between something that needs, that value adds can work on, and something that's just hopeless in a lot of ways? Like, what do y'all look for in a property that tells you, yes, we can add value to it?
Huh, that's a good question. Yeah, so keeping things simple is always going to be a great guiding light for me. Maybe I'm just too risk adverse, but you know, a lot of times you'll hear broadly folks talk about, oh, does that property or this property have meat on the bone? You know, the man that's saying, we love talking about it that way in real estate. And what that really means to me is we prefer looking at deals that are in heavily populated areas. We're not buying a deep value add. We're buying, I mean, really, I would say like light value add, forced appreciation plays along with partners that already have the infrastructure. I can barely swing a hammer. You know, I partner with GP teams and I join the GP teams along with them. My wife, Jennifer, is far more handy around the house than I am any day of the week, Adam. You know, YouTube saves my butt every day on that stuff. But when it comes to de-risking the deal, looking at the economics of the deal, looking at the, you know, can we go and invest X per unit into doing, you know, Y renovation to get Z output. That's the stuff that makes sense to me. And I, you know, thankfully I'd say right now more than ever, what really matters is making sure you can go and do full upgrade of as many units as you can in an apartment building within a reasonably, you know, light lift and doing a repositioning of that asset, to say that the non-industry speak way. You're trying to buy an apartment that you could basically go and, you know, responsibly raise the rents by putting in new property management that's more competent, that's more hands-on, as well as also going in and adding an improved living experience for the tenants that are going there. So you're not just raising rents because you can. And then at the end, you know, you're going to be able to exit that deal at a profit. Now, it is harder to buy deals right now just because 2023 is making, you know, the banking landscape is a little bit more volatile than it was about a year ago, right? To say the least. But I would say that in a nutshell, that's really what's most interesting. You know, still buying, interested in buying properties that you're going to see at or around, like, not, you know, some folks will say, is it really a value add deal if it's at 90% plus occupancy? And it's like, well, you know, welcome to 2023 to those folks is my response. And yes, it is. It just means it's not a heavy value add for a half empty zombie apocalypse building. And so, you know, we like to stick to the stuff that's more of a light value add relative to the deep.
So lower ceiling, higher floor type properties are what you're looking for.
Yep.
Nice. So what is your, if you had to boil it down to one metric that you like to use when you first evaluate deals to see if it's even worth it, do you have a specific metric that you like to look at as just kind of a first blush, yes, this might be something I'm interested in?
You know, this is one of those fun topics to debate people on. I still think that IRR, it can be really fickle. But I still think that that's a helpful number to look at. And I think, for like, again, for folks that are hearing me say this, that isn't necessarily like, Adam, and you correct me if I'm wrong, you're talking about if I'm the active operator, if I'm buying, not if I'm the passive investor investing into
a deal. Yeah. When you're looking at a deal.
Yeah. I mean, IRR or yield on cost, you know, I think IRR is still great.
Okay. And where do you see the market 1 year from now? You mentioned the landscape of lending is different now than it was a year ago, but how do you see the real estate market in a year?
Oof. Big crystal ball caveat on this. I think, you know, we got some good, well, we got some confirmation from the Fed just yesterday that they made another 25 basis point hike in their interest rates, which will hopefully keep us at what will be the plateau level, the highest level of interest rate rises for this cycle. So to take a step back, I will just say, I think that there is not going to be a doom and gloom crash on one end of the negative, let's go to the negative end of the spectrum of what's possible. I just don't see that occurring. I don't see that occurring because just as recently as today, we are already seeing in much of the country, take out the coastal markets like the one I'm sitting in here, single family price points in a lot of markets have come back to the levels that they were at before a dip. And we're talking, you know, just in the last like 24 months. So that's a strong indicator. You've also going to have a bunch of pent up demand as interest rates start to come back down, assuming that they will, which is what almost every prevailing source thinks that they will come back down into 2024 and 2025. Not to go too technical, I'll just say that means you're going to have more people buying more homes again on the single family front. And that demand in the meantime is going to get pretty darn pent up because transactions are looking slow. So I think that that's actually a more boring story than some people are waiting for. The thing that's going to be kind of the bogey or the unknown on the positive is like, we're going to see what happens with the banks. You know, like can people get loans? Who are they going to get those loans from? You know, as a guy who, you know, we have also banked with the First Republic. So like, you know, we have multiple banks, but just to say it out loud, like it's weird to see like, oh yeah, our home mortgage is not going to be owned and serviced for the next 20 something years by a different bank. But hey, that's just the norm right now. Not to make light of some stuff that is hardship. Like, I think this is going to be more boring than people expect in a good way. I think for the average person that's sitting out there, outside from the fact we can get higher savings accounts rates right now, which seems great. Mortgages are more expensive than a euro. Not so great. I think that it's going to be a housing market that's just a little bit more flat than it is, you know, doom and gloom, with a rosy looking outlook in the years after that.
Nice. And so you mentioned that, you know, you've done investing in the Midwest, you're doing Sunbelt stuff. What is there a specific market right now that you're most keen on, one that impresses you the most or you expect to see the most upside on? Like, is there one market that kind of sticks out in your head?
Oh, there's so many to choose from, Adam. If I had to pick one, ironically, it's the one that we focused on the most in the first couple of years of actually launching like our investing club and investing our capital as LPs in like larger deals. And that is the massive footprint of Dallas, Texas. Big fan of many markets, you know, all the way out to North Carolina, South Carolina, you know, Georgia, as well as like Colorado and Arizona, et cetera. But it was fascinating to see the tone change from an investor landscape. You know, you and I talk to investors of all sorts all the time. And in my lens, on this really fun investing world, interesting investing world we all work in, the sentiment in 2017, 2018 was like, oh man, Dallas is looking really good. Dallas, Fort Worth, massive footprint, by the way. Like it's just absolutely enormous footprint. Like it's like 170 individual cities in there mixed in. So when people say it, I'm like, man, I go there like 3 or 4 times a year and I'm still sitting there going like, I have to look at this map again. It's massive. So to give it proper credit, that's got to be it. I think that market has still got the gas in the tank. People in 2019 and 2020 were saying, oh, looking pretty saturated. I'm like, yeah, everyone's changed the tune again back to, oh, Dallas is great. And it's like, because that's never been, it's never really changed from my perspective because the job inflow and the company favorable environment continues to kick butt. And that's not something I see changing anytime soon.
Fantastic. And what would you say to an investor today that they should be doing to position themselves in a better place 5 years from now? I know you said, you know, maybe read 24 minus 21 books to before you get started. But what would you say to an investor who's thinking about getting started now and you're saying, hey, do this to be better in 5 years?
This sounds really fundamental, but this is my belief. Revisit your investment thesis. Let me say it in the more helpful human way because investment thesis sounds weird. I would say gut check your goals. Like, what's the goal for the money? And that's something I think I am guilty of not revisiting, which is why I say it. Great example back to the very beginning of our conversation today, Adam. You know, looking at the first time Jennifer and I sat down for our own money and we were like, what are we going to go do here? Like, what's the big change we're going to go for? We set a time horizon of 15 years out to be financially free, meaning cover all expenses. And then we were like 3 months later saying that's too long. And it was. So we chopped it in half. We're like, now what do we have to go do to hit that goal? Cash flow goals changed for us, you know, and hopefully for other people too. If they're sitting there saying how to be a better real estate investor in 5 years from now, I would ask them, why are they investing the way they are investing? And if they can't answer that question, go and ask the one above it, which is like, what's the goal, right? Like, what's the goal for the money? Are you trying to hit a cash flow number? Are you trying to grow your wealth and diversify? Because those are very different. You know, those are like, one is a growth play and one is a cash flow play. And if you're trying to pivot out of your job, you know, if you're a $400,000 a year senior software engineer at Meta, AKA Facebook, you like your job, you're probably not looking for that much cash flow. You know, if you own a construction company out in Georgia and you're a third generation owner, these are profiles of real people we work with, obviously, but keep it anonymous. You know, you might want to have some cash flow buffer because you want to have an off ramp from your ownership. And eventually you want to be able to just kind of be out of the game and go play on your boat. You know, it just depends. And so I would ask people to, or encourage people rather, to sit down and like really think about like, that's how you can become a better real estate investor. First and foremost, as high level as it sounds, is first, just what's the goal for the money, then go solve the rest.
Fantastic. So like I mentioned at the beginning, you are CEO of Madison Investing. Tell us a little bit about the company and kind of who your, you know, your avatar is for who you fit with in terms of investment.
Yeah. And thanks again, Adam. Yeah. So Madison Investing, passive investing club, super simple model. It's served us well. We go and share the same sponsors and teams that we have invested our own money with before. And we have already vetted them. I've flown out, locked the assets, the buildings, the state, done the due diligence, and put them through our framework. And so we've done that now 45 times. We have hundreds of active investors. And it's just a joy to be able to help them achieve the same kind of stuff that we've achieved and just learn from them, frankly, all over the country. So it's really just a pleasure to help other passive investors find their way.
Yeah. And so if I'm an investor thinking this may or may not be right for me, is there a specific profile that you think, you know, this investor is a great fit for us?
I mean, candidly, like we started out that way where a lot of the folks in our group were, you know, come from my style of network, from the tech world. Now it runs the gamut. You know, I mean, we truly have folks from every walk of life and hundreds of investors from all parts of the United States, you know? And so that's, there is no like right or wrong profile. I would just say the only thing is we can only accept accredited investors currently. And, you know, folks, if they're not familiar with that, you know, that's just a quick Google away, but I'm here to help, you know, and just jump on a phone call. It's not an obligation or a fee-based thing to join. You will have to speak with me on a call, which is both for compliance and frankly, many years ago, made the decision that we only wanted to work with other, you know, very friendly, reasonable human beings when we do this. So, which, you know, thankfully the lion's share of the time is the case, and we welcome people to be new members.
All right. Well, fantastic. Well, Spencer, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate all the insight you gave us. Again, he is the CEO of Madison Investing. That website is madisoninvesting.com. That's madisoninvesting.com. And thank you so much for joining us today and listening into this podcast and taking the time to educate yourself. If you want a copy of Zach's best 20 markets to invest in 2023, you can send an email to podcast@renttoretirement.com and we will get that sent out to you as soon as possible. Again, that's podcast@renttoretirement.com. Really appreciate the time that you spent educating yourself today, and we'll talk to you on the next episode.